Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Alan Jones, Dean Emeritus of Grace Cathedral, and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, the renowned airline pilot who successfully landed his plane in the Hudson River in 2009 and who is here today to discuss his new book, Making a Difference, Stories of Vision and Courage from America's Leaders. Now, I'm sure many here in the audience and listening in feel as unheroic as I do, but I want you to take heart. There was a comforting anecdote in the magazine section of the New York Times yesterday. President Obama asked Captain Sullenberger whether the attention was going to his head. The captain's wife responded, "Mr. President, the world may think him a hero, but he still snores." And I can say, me too. More seriously, of course, when I finished reading the book, one word kept resonating in my mind: resilience. Resilience when it comes to both the development of character and the craft. I want to use that word, the craft of being human. Sometimes a particular moment in history, perhaps only a few seconds, meets with a particular person, and that meeting makes a difference. Captain Sully Sullenberger is such a person whose training, discipline, and character came together in a special moment to save and to change lives. So please welcome Captain Sully Sullenberger.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan, for that wonderful welcome. Can you hear me okay in the back? This isn't quite tall enough, but I'll make do. Alan, I want to say, with your beautiful accent, my first name, Chesley, comes out just so. And thank you for not making it Chelsea. No wonder I have a nickname. Thank you for coming tonight. We promise that we'll finish on time so that those of you who are fans of a house will be able to see the final episode tonight when it airs. What a mind-bending 3 years that my family and I have had. Or as my first officer on the flight 1549 to the Hudson River said very early on, imagine this. You land a $60 million airliner in a river and they call you a hero. Is this a great country or what? But one of the biggest surprises for all of us directly involved in Flight 1549 was that, unlike almost every other news story, this one didn't fade away with the end of the news cycle because of the way it happened, when it happened, where it happened, the time in the world's history when we were very much looking for good news, searching for reasons to feel hopeful again. And then on that day in that place, a group of people came together who made it their mission in life to see that good was done and that lives were saved. And it gave people hope. It served as a reminder, when we very much needed one, of the goodness that is still existing in the world and has the potential for good in each of us. And so when we first figured out that that was the case, my first officer, Jeff Skiles, and I, in the first week, I think we were just at the inauguration, felt an intense obligation to use this notoriety for good, to keep our faith with our colleagues who are still working as airline pilots and flight attendants, to right wrongs, to make aviation safer, to restore to its proper status the airline piloting profession, and to remind people that in spite of how easy we make air travel look, in spite of how routine and commonplace it is, that what we are doing when we take you up in an airliner is we're actually pushing a tube filled with people through the upper atmosphere 7 miles above the Earth at 80% of the speed of sound in a hostile environment with outside temperatures to minus 70, and we must return it safely to the surface every time. And we do. Over millions of flights. We make it look easy, but it's not. It's hard. If it were easy, everyone could do it, and that's simply not the case. It requires a certain dedication to do this well. A dedication to doing the right thing on every flight, even when it's not at all convenient. And so Jeff and I felt a sense of mission. And that mission continues. And so in the last 3 years, my family and I have had amazing opportunities to go to incredible places, to meet people we would never have met in 100 normal lifetimes. I've received an award from Prince Philip in Buckingham Palace in the Coronation Ballroom. We've met the President and the First Lady, who were very gracious and generous with their time. And I think for each of us in our family, there's one highlight that each of us feels was most special. For my older daughter, who is now a freshman at Cal Poly, it was meeting the President. For my younger daughter, just 2 years her junior, it was meeting the Jonas Brothers. And for me, it was probably in May 2009, for the first time, even though we'd supported them in our own small way over the years, I had a chance to visit St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and meet the patients and their families and the staff. And I thought I had seen courage in my life, but I really hadn't until I'd met people who, at such a young age, can face such great challenges with such grace. And so we had yet another opportunity when we filmed a public service announcement for St. Jude. Some of these people I've met were people that I had admired and respected for decades. And I had the amazing opportunity to have conversations with them, to interview them, where I got to ask the questions for a change. And surprisingly, they all said yes. And I attribute it at least partly to what I call the enduring power of this story of Flight 1549 to touch and inspire people. But regardless of the reason, I did have these conversations. And I was looking for common themes, themes that I thought I would find, and I did. But I also wanted to be challenged. I wanted to be surprised. And I was. The first profile in the book is Admiral Thad Allen. And I'll tell you just one quick story about him, one that still resonates with me. He's the recently retired commandant of the Coast Guard who was brought in the darkest hours of the initial response to Hurricane Katrina. And he found relief workers, thousands of them, who had been beaten up daily in the press, who were completely demoralized. And so he did what any good commander does, and that's to call an all-hands meeting. And his military aide, who you'll read in the book, was interestingly enough named Katrina, said, "Admiral, there are 4,000 people in this headquarters building." He said, "Well, get as many of them in one place as you can." And so they got 2,500 people on the first floor of this building. Admiral Allen stood up on a desk, grabbed a microphone, and said to them, "I want you to listen to me. I'm going to give you an order. I want you to treat everyone you come in contact with as if they were a member of your immediate family, as if they were your father, your mother, your brother, your sister. And if you do this, two things are going to happen. First, if you make a mistake, you'll probably err on the side of doing too much, not too little. And second, if anyone has a problem with what you've done, then their problem is with me and not with you." He said you could hear a giant collective sigh of relief emanate from the entire room. People began to weep because no one had told them that what they were doing was important and why, or that their boss was behind them. And in just a few words, he did that. And he gave them hope. And he turned the entire response around. And then, of course, he applied these same techniques of leading by personal example to the oil spill in the Gulf and to the response to the hurricane, to the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. And that's just one story and one chapter. And all these people I spoke with, Lieutenant Colonel Tammy Duckworth, Jim Senegal, Michelle Reed, they all told me such personal, powerful, inspiring stories that I just had to share them. So that's why the book. And that's how the book. And so I hope that that the stories move you. I hope that you are like I was, reminded that we have lots of people who are leaders, even if they don't have a big job or a fancy title. We have lots of people who, a lot of people who do their jobs really well and lead others on a daily basis. We just don't know who they all are because they haven't been as publicly tested. So let's talk about the book.
Thank you. It seems to me that one of the things that I got out of your book is that you alluded to just now was a kind of antidote to cynicism. Because human beings, I mean, we can go off into fantasy land about life, but the notion that everybody matters, that, you know, you treat everyone as if you're a member of your family, as you mentioned. But I wondered how that evolved for you. You know, there's Facebook. You have a lot of followers on Facebook, and there's a kind of celebrity status that goes along with what you've done and the publishing of two books. I wondered how you handle the aftermath of the event, becoming an icon, a celebrity, a hero.
With great difficulty. We had help, of course, but I had the advantage 3 years ago when this began of being 57, almost 58 years old. And I lived my life in such a way that, to the extent it's possible, I think it had been a pretty good preparation for what was to follow. I had the great advantage of growing up in a family in which education was valued, ideas were important, and in which striving for excellence was expected of me. Can you hear okay in the back? Okay, good. My mom was a first grade teacher. My dad was a professional. And I had a lifelong love of learning and of reading. I was naturally intellectually curious. I was an inveterate reader throughout my life, and so I was literate. I had already figured out what I believed about many things, what I thought about many things. And so I think that, as much as anything, helped me to be a public figure. But in spite of that, it was traumatic. It was having the biggest fire hose pointed at you for at least a year and a half. It was an incredibly steep learning curve to be able to be public figures, to have the confidence, to have the ability to be articulate enough to be a public figure.
You wrote that, "I believe my preparation for the events of Flight 1549 began even before my birth." And that means a kind of sense of your lineage.
Well, it means that all four of my grandparents who were born in the 19th century went to college. And that was remarkable,
rare,
especially for women of that era. Mm. And so I think, again, that value placed on education, on learning, on lifelong learning.
Mm. Yeah. I think before we get into some of the stories about the 11 remarkable people in your book, I was struck by the recurring theme of your critiquing the culture in which we live right now, because while you are optimistic, you talk about realistic optimism, you also have a theme through the book. It's gentle, but it's very strong, of critiquing the culture and the danger we're in of missing what really matters. So I'd like you to talk about the things we're missing, a deep sense of community, a call to serve the common good, those kinds of things. Because there is a critique here as well as affirmation.
Absolutely. I think that many people feel that. Many people wonder if we are pursuing the correct path, if we have the values that we need to be successful as a society. I think many people feel that the values that that we have inherited from our fathers, our grandfathers, our grandmothers, are not as apparent as they once were. Quite frankly, they seem to have gotten lost in the noise, all this noise in our popular culture. I think they still exist. To what extent, it's difficult to say. I know that the youngest generations, particularly those who are serving in the military around the world, have these and have learned these. There's no doubt that the modern generations have the ability to do what every generation has done, to be the greatest generation when called upon. But in our society, I do notice a coarseness. I do notice that there is less good agreement on what public behavior and what poor public values should be. And while there are people who have lots who have values, it just doesn't seem like they're the ones who are leading us on a daily basis. And I think each of us has a responsibility to do a couple of things, to behave in accordance with our values, regardless of whether others do or not, to educate ourselves and be aware and engaged, particularly as voters. Even something as simple as reading a good newspaper every week, even if it's online, and not just listening to sound bites would be a great start. I think that part of what I admire about everyone in this book is that they view the world the same way, as an opportunity for good. They are willing to, as Gene Kranz and others say, literally check their egos at the door to do things for the right reason, to serve a cause, to be willing to serve a cause rather than themselves and their own immediate needs. And I think if we did that, it would be a great start.
I wondered in the light of that, my worry about leadership, the issues of leadership and books on leadership. Some of them don't emphasize a kind of moral compass in the sense that, you know, I think of history, the destructive leaders. I mean, Hitler was an amazing leader. The whole German people virtually followed him. Lenin, how one differentiates between kind of great figures of history where they did great harm but millions followed them to a kind of a moral compass. And presumably, you got that compass from parents and grandparents and education. But I wonder if you could say something about the fact that if you're not informed, then you become. I'm really asking a question about the followers. How do you become a responsible follower, so that you can differentiate between a good leader and a bad one?
A couple of things occur to me. Yes, you're exactly right. Without real core values and then the integrity and the courage to choose to live by them, then there can be no great leadership. We also must be capable of what I call independent critical thought. We must be able to be critical of those who try to convince us of things that really aren't so. We need to be literate. We need to be scientifically literate, particularly now. We need to be informed voters. We need to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. We shouldn't believe everything that we hear and read. We should be able to form opinions for ourselves. I think one of the most fundamental responsibilities of being human, quite frankly, is to decide for ourselves what the purpose of our lives to be is to be, and not to rely on received wisdom, no matter the source.
Mm. Sally, I realize something logistically a problem right now. Is that people can't see you. They don't need to see me.
Stand?
But if you'd stand at the podium.
That's a good idea.
And they can infer that I exist. Sitting.
Thank you, Alan. That will help a lot.
Sitting here. I think, too, of leadership. You talked about, I don't know how many seconds it was, you know, coming onto the Hudson River, that there was a meeting of the moment and your training. And that sometimes leadership is, there's a quality there, but the actual moment of leadership is quite short, a short moment. I think of Winston Churchill, who was fantastic, you know, right for that moment, and then before the Second World War and after it, although he was re-elected, was somewhat in the shadows. And you think of Margaret Thatcher, who in her first term had a great energy and power, and in her second term she seemed to lose it. So it's sort of that combination of the two things that, as you said, there are many people who are leaders, but we don't know them. But not to underestimate the fact of just doing something faithfully every day actually makes a difference to the Commonwealth.
And sometimes that's actually the more difficult case.
Yeah.
I mean, I, as an airline captain, I would often fly every week with people I'd never met before. In a large airline, that happens all the time. And so I would begin a week of flying, make the introductions, and one of the things that we've taught in our leadership courses pilots to do is to set the proper tone, to open channels of communication, to align goals, to create a shared sense of responsibility for the outcome, and begin building a team out of this collection of individuals. So if something bad were to happen on the very first takeoff, we'd be as likely to successfully handle it together as would normally develop over the course of days or weeks of working together. So I think often having the discipline, the diligence to do what's required and comply with our professional responsibilities on an hourly, a daily basis is often, you know, in some ways more difficult than responding to a crisis that's more well-defined. Of course, in our situation, it was not that well-defined. What was particularly challenging about Flight 1549 was it was a novel and unanticipated situation for which we had never specifically trained. We had trained for portions of it, but never in even the most extreme demanding flight simulator scenarios have we practiced everything going wrong that happened at such a low altitude and in such a short time frame. We had this happened 100 seconds after we took off. The flight from the point where we hit the berth until we had landed was 208 seconds. And so the time pressure, the workload was so extreme that my first officer, Jeff Skiles, and I didn't even have a chance to have a conversation about what was going on. I had to rely upon him being highly experienced and having 20,000 hours like I did and knowing immediately and intuitively what to do because I didn't have time to direct him.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of questions, written questions, about who might have inspired you, historical figures in the past, and I wondered if there's a kind of group of people that you particularly admired.
You know, I think I'm 61, so from my parents' generation certainly inspired me, the Churchills, the Eisenhowers, people like that. But I also really admired people that I profile in the book, people like Robert Reich, one of the most intellectually challenging and stimulating of all the conversations I had, people who have not really received the due that they should, but people who have fantastic ideas that I wish we would act on.
The question that comes up a lot in these written ones is, what advice would you offer a high school senior heading off to college in the fall? Don't go into debt.
No, I won't. Don't go into debt. You know, I value education greatly. There is a great debate now about whether or not colleges are doing their jobs well. I wouldn't be an art history major unless you see a clear path in that direction. One of the big problems that we have in our society, as you know, is there's a great mismatch between the jobs that are available and the skill sets that many people have. And so I think as a society, the college education issue aside just for a moment, and this is something I talked to former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, the first female Attorney General of Michigan and the first female governor of Michigan, when she talks about what's happened to the manufacturing jobs in Michigan, and when they first realized that this was a structural problem, a global structural problem, they brought all their resources to bear in a holistic fashion, breaking down silos, having all the departments work together, having all the community college work together, having all the businesses work together to try to find a better match between skill sets and the available jobs. As the manufacturing jobs leave and we have more service jobs, it means that people even with a college degree are not going to necessarily have the kind of the jobs that they had. Robert Reich talks about no longer having job security, but possibly, if we do it right, having employability security. And one of the things they did in Michigan and like to see us do elsewhere is to, as quickly as possible, identify those whose jobs probably are not coming back mm-hmm. and to begin to retrain them as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So I would say for those entering college now, if you were lucky like me and you were fortunate enough to find your life's passion at an early age and you know exactly what you want to do, get specialized training in that field. And if not, try to find a major, whether it's business or something else, that will have as wide an applicability as possible.
A friend of mine told his graduating son, don't look for a job, look for a customer. In other words, sort of you've got to be much more entrepreneurial in terms of...
And I think also one of the points that I make in the book is that we must be lifelong learners, that we've gotten so far past the days where people can get through an entire working lifetime with only one skill set. We have to not only change jobs, we have to change professions, we have to improve our skills, learn new ones, we have to reinvent ourselves.
Now, you interviewed 11 remarkable people, some of them really well-known, some not so well-known, who exhibit these leadership qualities. How did you come to choose these 11?
I chose people I admired and respected, and I intentionally made it as eclectic, diverse a group as I could. I intentionally chose some that were well known, but whose stories all hadn't been told that completely. I also chose someone who were not well known, but all of whom led by example. All of whom obviously displayed personal courage and integrity, moral courage. All of whom were willing to serve something greater than their own immediate mm-hmm. needs. One of the ones I talk about that people have never heard of before is a mom of two from Boise, Idaho, named Sue Sheridan.
Yes.
And in my patient safety work, in applying what we've learned in aviation safety to medicine to save lives, and many of you may know that right now in this country, between hospital errors and hospital-acquired conditions, 200,000 lives are lost in this country every year. If that were to happen in my domain, I can tell you quite frankly, about the second day, the entire system would be shut down. There would be a presidential commission. There would be a congressional hearing. The NTSB couldn't handle the load, and they would begin to do investigations, and no one would fly. I guess it would be similar to September 11, 2001. Mm-hmm. No one would fly until we'd solve the problem. Because it happens a few at a time, it's become almost thought of as an unavoidable consequence of providing care. So Sue Sheridan's family experienced two awful and preventable medical tragedies. And rather than being devastated by despair and bitterness and anger, she became one of the world's foremost patient safety advocates, and she single-handedly has changed the standard of care for newborns globally.
There is, you brought up the issue if it had happened in your neck of the woods. There's a question here. My understanding is that it would in fact be safer for airlines to fly without pilots. Where technology supersedes pilot error in relation to risk factor. Do you concur?
Technology provides for wonderful functionality and great displays of information. It can do what it's programmed to do. It can do what's been foreseen. It cannot do otherwise. What we have now, of course, is a human and technology system in our airplanes and in many other domains. And we need to make sure that the roles are assigned appropriately, that take into account the human and the technological limitations and strengths. And that's likely to be the case for the future. I can't quite frankly imagine getting on an airplane in which there was not a human pilot.
The next question about technology, did flight instruments tell you you couldn't make it?
No.
So there
was no one's imitation that told me whether or not I could make it. Mm. And the suddenness of this event, the severity of this event, caused in me a very intense startle effect, a natural human physiological reaction to this sudden life-threatening stress. I could feel in the first seconds, even as the event was unfolding, my pulse, my blood pressure shoot up. I sensed my perceptual field narrow because of the stress, but I had the discipline to compartmentalize and focus and fly the airplane in spite of it. But the way I decided that we could not reach a runway was by looking out the window and eyeballing it, based upon thousands of hours in the air. And the fact that Jeff and I were able to make those choices under those conditions and in that time frame and get them right is what is remarkable.
Did you know you had hit birds?
Yes, I saw the birds about 1.5 or 2 seconds before we struck them. And at that point, we were traveling at 316 feet per second, so I saw them about 1.5 or 2 football field lengths away, but clearly not enough time to maneuver this big airplane away from them. As they approached, I saw the birds fill the windscreen as if it were a Hitchcock film. I could feel and hear the thumps and thuds as we struck them across the leading edges of the wings, the nose, and into both engines. The engines immediately were damaged irreparably, it turns out, and I could feel the severe vibrations and hear the terrible noises as they were being destroyed. Imagine finely balanced machinery spinning at thousands of revolutions per minute and having a 10 or 12 pound bird with a 5 or 6 foot wingspan go through it, through the center of it, through the core of it, is incredibly damaging, disruptive. And then the thrust loss. You know, it felt as if the forward momentum of the airplane nearly stopped, as if the bottom had fallen out of our world. And so we were left with the challenge of a lifetime in the first couple of seconds.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, and there are several questions like this. Will you run for public office?
I am honored to be thought of in that way by some. I'm convinced that I can be more effective outside government than within.
I want to go back. You mentioned Admiral Tad Allen, and then echoing actually something in Tammy Duckworth. I'd like you to talk about her, because both of them have this simple but elusive gift of acknowledging another's existence, of are not contributing to someone's or rendering someone invisible. And I think that's what that was another theme. The resilience came to me, but this notion of actually being present to other human beings and acknowledging their reality. And that also has that moral compass notion, because it guards against a phrase you use, the drift towards expedience of cutting corners and so on. Could you say something about those two, Admiral Tad Allen and Tammy Duckworth, having those similar qualities and those different personalities, of course.
Yeah, and I also wanted to get back to what I was going to say earlier, that one of the terms that Admiral Allen uses to describe what we did on our flight was much similar to what he had done in his professional career. He said he had mastered his craft, and then he'd mastered himself to be able to handle whatever might come, to be more expert at whatever might come. Lieutenant Colonel Tammy Duckworth really impressed me with the intensity of her courage, her physical color courage, her mental courage, and her identification with and her loyalty to those under her command. She told me several stories in response to my direct questioning about what were the most difficult decisions you ever had to make. Were you ever asked to do something that was just wrong, that just was against all your values? And she said, yes, actually many of them did. Bill Bratton did. And I asked her how she handled it. I said, was it a difficult choice to make? And she described a couple of scenes. One was in which she was asked to fly in weather that was not conducive to flight in a helicopter. And there was a heated argument with a superior. And she finally convinced this officer that if there was an American bleeding to death, that she would taxi her helicopter down a dirt road if she had to, because the ceiling of visibility wouldn't allow flight. But that until then, she was not going to put her crews at life for a mission that wasn't worth their lives. In another case, they were supposed to pick up some prisoners from Abu Ghraib and fly them to another location. and the landing zone that was designated for them for the pickup was not secure. And so she pushed back hard, and she asked for a company to secure the area for an hour before and an hour after their time on arrival. And her boss got threats to discipline her. Mm. Ultimately, her needs were met, and the mission went off without a hitch. She said that later, paradoxically, her men, her crews, would have done more and riskier things for her than they were for others, because they knew that she had their backs.
And she could trust. They could.
They could trust her.
The basic issue of trust.
Trust. And she led by example, and she was willing to put it on the line and pay a professional price if she needed to.
Another question that recurs is with yourself and with these others, the issue of faith. Not a particular one. I mean, whatever your faith is, but did your faith play a role in the decisions you made on that miraculous day on the Hudson River?
I'm going to take the definition as a more literal one and say it would then be aligned with what I call realistic confidence, realistic optimism.
Yes, realistic. You use that.
And so it's holding two thoughts, two very different thoughts in your mind simultaneously. Having the confidence based on real work, actual capabilities, not wishful thinking, that ultimately we can survive. Ultimately we can overcome this obstacle. Ultimately we can achieve our goals. At the same time, having a full and accurate appreciation of our immediate difficulties. And so on that flight, I never thought I was going to die that day. I was confident I could find a way to solve the problem. And I didn't think about anything else. I never thought about my family. I never thought about the passengers. I thought about flying the airplane and taking it where we would be best suited. And that's all. That's all there was time for.
And it was that kind of clarity.
Yeah. I mean, I in this unfamiliar situation that we never trained for, I was able to quickly synthesize a lifetime of training and experience and impose that paradigm on this situation, thereby clarifying it and making it a problem that I then knew how to solve.
I want to ask you a strange question, because it's not directly referred to in your book, but in spite of my accent and being able to pronounce your first name quite nicely.
Thank you very much.
I am a proud American citizen. I became a citizen in 1975. And listening to you now, what is it that you love about America?
I had another wonderful opportunity a year and a half ago in September 2010 to be on a CNBC program moderated by Marita Bartiromo. And it was called The Future of Leadership. And it was at West Point, New York, the U.S. Military Academy. And we had an audience of some 300 or 400 cadets. And retired General Wesley Clark was there. Hank Paulson was there. IBM CEO was there. A number of other high-level people. And this question came up in a different form. And I said then, and I'll say the same thing now, that I think it has been the ideas of America as much as the idea of America that has captured the imaginations of people around the world. And it is when we are truest to those ideals that we have been the most successful and the most respected around the world.
Yeah, I find this great experiment so thrilling that in spite of all our problems, there is a sense in which there is no such thing, including Native Americans, there's no such thing as an ethnic American. We're all mongrels. We're all a mixture of things. We're all, and we've come, some of us were immigrants a long time ago, our families, to forge a new life here. But the issue of resilience and trust And another issue that comes up is, and it's a very explosive one politically, is how we care for one another without fostering a kind of sense of entitlement. The issues of entitlement come up a lot in the book as well.
So it's not that we share a certain creed or race, it's that we share certain common virtues, certain common ideals. Mm. And I think we still, for the most part, do, but there seems to be some disagreement about some of them these days. And it disturbs me that we are so extremely hyper-partisan. I don't think it's reality. Mm. I think that one of the disadvantages of having so many outlets. Now, it's analogous to me to going in the bookstore and seeing that there are 20,000 magazines of every kind. Right. You can find a magazine about cat grooming you name it, and there's one for it. I think our media are almost that way. And people who can so selectively narrow their point of view to the extent that they never have to listen to anything they disagree with. They never have to hear another voice. And I think that doesn't serve us well. I think that that we do really have more in common than we suspect, than we're willing to admit. And we need to act on that.
Margaret Thatcher was asked to explain the American political two-party system. And she said there are two political parties. There is the Republican Party, which is roughly the equivalent of our Conservative Party. And there is the Democratic Party, which is roughly the equivalent of our Conservative Party.
And so people have asked me recently whether I was a Republican or a Democrat, and my answer is always the same, that I'm an American first, and I vote as an American first.
Good. Excellent. That theme comes up. I really enjoyed your interview with John Bogle in his 80s. The founder of the Vanguard Group, mutual funds and so on. And here again, the recurring theme of corporate greed, excess and complacency. And his call, coming from, the founder of Vanguard Group, his call for humanism in an arena not exactly famous for placing people above profit. And that's one of the phrases in the book. And being in finance, his finding our polarized political system appalling. A Republican who voted for Obama, which makes it very complicated. And I wonder that theme of greed and selfishness and excess and complacency came up quite a bit in his...
It did, and also in several of the other interviews with Robert Reich, for example, and... Professor Reich and I had a fascinating conversation about just that topic and the fact that, human nature is the same as it's always been. People are as greedy now as they ever were, but no more probably. What's changed is the rules of the game. And now we have very smart people who have found very creative ways to game the system. And now we have, with the way our political campaigns are financed, huge donations that buy access to legislators and to regulators and can get rules written to benefit their particular segment of society. And it's possible for a few people to drive the bus off the cliff with all of us on it every once in a while. And so it's that we need to align the goals toward more public good. We need to set the rules of the game so that there's more equal opportunity and that more public good can be done, in my opinion.
Mm. There was a New Yorker cartoon recently of a man in a bar saying to the bartender, "I know I'm nothing, but I'm all I can think about." It was lovely. But the another recurring theme, and I'm thinking of Tammy Duckworth again, how liberating, too, what it means to be part of something bigger than yourself. It was a sort of sense of gratitude, for what we have, but also with an element of sacrifice. You write, once her initial, this is Tammy Duckworth, once her initial concerns about the safety of her crew were allayed, Duckworth had to focus on learning to live without legs and with a severely damaged arm, with no, at least I got no sense of self-pity, no sense of poor me at all.
No, as a matter of fact, she celebrates her Alive Day with great gratitude, the anniversary of her rescue and recovery from the battlefield. Initially, they thought they were recovering her body until they realized that she was bleeding. But, you know, she also describes how liberating it was to have faced that ultimate challenge for her. And so now, quite frankly, what she'll do when she's facing some great challenge is she'll say to herself, this is not my darkest hour. This is not my darkest day, because I've had that darkest hour and that darkest day, and this isn't it. I think there was one other who felt a similar and often almost difficult to understand gratitude, and that was Sue Sheridan, when she had become a world-renowned patient safety advocate and had the opportunity to save others' lives. She was grateful for that, even though it had come at such a great price.
I mean, with her, I think that that was the story that certainly made my eyes moist.
And then especially, especially as I say, that final astonishing anecdote at the end of her chapter.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that the MRI showed abnormalities in the boy's brain, but no one had shared the results with her. And a simple procedure would have made all the difference.
Well, actually, he didn't have the MRI. It was her husband. Had the sarcoma. She was told it was benign.
Right. I find you mentioned Jennifer Granholm. There were lots of made me think about Congress, where she said negotiation and compromise are hallmarks of leadership. It's my way or the highway is a sign of bad leadership.
Yeah, she said failure to compromise is a failure of leadership.
Yeah, right.
And she also very much likes, in fact, the pull quote at the beginning of her chapter is that one of a leader's responsibilities is to plant trees under whose shade you will never sit.
That's a great phrase, I think.
And we have huge, complex problems now that will be multi-generational in solving, and the sooner we start, the better.
Yeah, right. A reminder to our listening audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, airline pilot and American hero, who is discussing his book, Making a Difference, Stories of Vision and Courage from America's Leaders. I'm Alan Jones, Dean Emeritus of Grace Cathedral. The other person I wanted to talk to is Gene Kranz. He was born 1933, flight director at Houston's Mission Control. And I keep thinking of the movie and Apollo 13. And here is another theme of a sense of duty coupled with being willing to learn from failure. Could you say something about learning from failure?
And handling risk, becoming more comfortable with the risk, which is somewhat akin to Tony La Russa, the legendary baseball manager, who recently led his team to the World Series win, when he talks about making pressure your friend. Right. So, yeah, Gene, of course, is a great guy. Everybody knows the story of Apollo 13, but he did much more. He'd been a fighter pilot, been an engineer. He's one of the ones who also learned, and in his words, to check his ego at the door, that a leader's greatest enemy is ego. That you have to be a servant leader. You have to be loyal to your people. You have to realize that respect must be earned. You have to lead in a genuine way with real values. And you have to hold those who work for you accountable. You have to expect high standards. And that's part of Michelle Rhee's message.
Yes, talk about
it. What impressed me about Michelle Rhee is that one of the first teaching jobs she had, an inner city school, and she admits she wasn't a very good teacher at first, but when she saw how unfair it was, how it just offended her sister, her sense of justice, her right and wrong, to see so many children whose opportunities, the trajectory of their lives was determined by the circumstances of their first few years. It just seemed un-American to her. And it fueled her anger, her passion to really make it about the students first, which is the name of her new organization. It just wasn't right, and she had to do something about it.
Do you think, I admired her a lot watching her being interviewed on television, but she did stir up an awful lot of hostility and then had, in a sense, left. I mean, did she succeed?
I think she succeeded in moving the dialogue along. She succeeded in putting focus on kids and not on adults.
Yeah. So in terms of the larger conversation, she was successful, but in terms of the Washington, D.C.
And I think she learned from failure, too. I mean, she didn't make the case. She didn't connect the dots. Mm-hmm. She assumed that, and this is sort of an engineering sort of a view of the world, almost. She assumed that the results would speak for themselves. Right. And, of course, they never do, particularly in politics.
Yes, you expect... It's a very, very odd to expect people to be rational.
There are too many vested interests, and she just didn't connect the dots for people.
Mm. You mentioned Robert Reich's intellect, and I respond to that, but I think what I found interesting was the key event in his life, or one of them, was the murder in 1964 of a civil rights friend, where he felt himself confronting evil as a crucible moment. And it's that kind of... Can you think of any particular events in your life? You talked about the influence of parents and grandparents and education and so on, but I wondered if there was a kind of crucible event for you.
There was, and I talk about it in the first book, Highest Duty. In the early 60s, I was about 13 years old, and it wasn't an event that touched my life. It was one I heard about in the press. There was a murder in Queens, in Kew Gardens, in New York City, Kitty Genovese. And the story was that she was stalked, attacked, and finally murdered one evening in view of and in hearing of several dozen people. And at the time, the story was that no one intervened. It's a bit more complicated than that, but in fact, she died and no one came to her aid in time. And I was growing up in a small town in North Texas, and that just seemed as if it had happened on a different planet. It didn't seem possible that people could behave in the way that had been described. What kind of people would behave that way? I couldn't imagine. It made me mad. It made me promise myself as a 13-year-old that if I was ever in a situation where someone needed my help, I would act. I would choose to act. I chose then. And so when something happened later, I didn't have to make up my mind. I already had. And I write in Highest Duty, I think that many people somewhere along the way, somewhere in their lives, had made a similar decision early on, that they wouldn't be a bystander, that they would act. If someone needed their help, they would give it gladly.
It's all that moral compass again, the sense of justice and of what's right. You talked to Jim Sinegal, the co-founder and CEO of Costco, concerning compensation packages that are just, again, a recurring theme about executive compensation, disproportion, and so on, and the resistance to pressure for short-term gains. I should think that would be very hard for a business person. I don't know.
I think it is.
Short-term gains.
I think it is. I think to do all these things is the harder way. You know, our business schools don't teach these kinds of leadership concepts, as far as I know. I think being a genuine leader with real values is probably harder than not. But it's better. And it's more effective. And there was actually a recent book out written by two Harvard Business School professors that said that actually money isn't always the best way to motivate people. That people really essentially want two things at work. They want to be in an environment in which they can do their best work. And then they want to know that what they've done matters. It's really almost as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And so I, getting back to Jennifer Granholm for a minute, one of the things that she said that I liked a lot is that, and we agreed on, is that we all need to be less dogmatic, more pragmatic, that we need to do what works, and that's in accordance with our values. And so with Jim Senegal, it was obvious to me that it was hard to meet the analysts' expectations when they're always clamoring for more every quarter, mm-hmm. and still run a good business, and still provide great value for your customers, to reward your shareholders, and to treat your employees as the valued assets and partners that they are. And Jim has found a way to do that by being an expert at a very difficult business, retail, by being more efficient, by engaging his workforce. He makes them more productive. He makes them more innovative. He makes them more as if they had a share in this business, a stake in it.
It's, again, rendering people visible and not just, you know, cogs in.
You know, I think it's been said, it's almost a cliche, but leaders lead people, not things. And managers should manage people, not numbers.
That's an interesting, you know, you quote Warren Bennis.
Yes.
American organizations have been overmanaged and underled.
He also says that when leaders treat followers with respect, followers respond with trust. Mm. And I've worked a lot of places where that was not the case. It was a shame because it didn't have to be that way.
Well, the kind of political climate we're in now, the recession, a cynical short-term leadership, and leaders in denial that Warren Bennis talks about. I mean, what would... since you're not going into politics, as far as we know, yet. You're shaking your head. What advice, or if you were giving a speech to Congress, what sort of 3 points might you make to our legislatures?
Change the way we finance our campaigns. That alone would be a huge first step, particularly after Citizens United, which was wrongheaded. I think the next thing we've got to do is we have to reward long-term performance. We should have our top executives compensated based upon their long-term performance, not their short-term performance. There was even a piece in the New York Times a few days ago by a group in London who have studied this, and they recommend not having public companies not even publish quarterly financial reports. Mm. Do it less frequently.
Yeah.
And one of the things we need to do is change, this is something that Robert Reich suggested, which I agree, is change the tax code to give a tax incentive to holding shares longer. Mm. That the longer you hold the shares, the less the tax rate.
Right. I wondered, one of the things that occurred to me as you've been speaking, and I hesitate to mention it since I'm too old for this, is do you think we lost something when the draft was abolished?
Yeah, we certainly have lost affecting every family. With our foreign policy, we certainly have lost a sense of duty, of civic duty to the country. What we've gained is a more professional military, but now we're overusing them, particularly the Guard and Reserve components.
It's just that it seems that the military bear a tremendous burden.
Yeah,
which the rest of us,
the military is too small for what we're asking them to do. Here's an example for you, and those of you who have a certain age and already know this, but for those of you who have forgotten or didn't, for the United States, not Europe, but for the United States, our total involvement in World War II was just over 3.5 years.
That's it.
Yeah. That's it. From Pearl Harbor to VJ Day. And the average combat tour in World War II was less than 24 months. Today, we're seeing four and five times that. These wars have lasted over a decade. And a tiny fraction of our population is doing all the heavy lifting. Everyone else has the luxury of pretending it doesn't exist. So while the draft provides more skin in the game for every family, it provides, I think, less quality professional forces. We've got to find some other way. There are alternatives to public service, but we all need to have a sense of civic duty. We all need to have a sense of community, and that's what engenders trust, and that's what's going to form a more cohesive nation.
Yes. I mean, I think that response is how one gets to that point again about the obligations of citizenship, the privileges of citizenship, the issues of duty, and being able to
in spite of what some people say, we in spite of what some people say, we have obligations to each other in this society.
We do. We are accountable to each other. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where I have to bring it to a conclusion. And I have to say, talking with you has been a strange combination. I've heard it, the little breath in the audience here, of both encouragement and disturbance. And I think we need both. If one reads the book carefully, it is both encouraging and challenging. And I think that was your intention. And I was reminded of three lines from an English poet. You'd expect George Herbert in the 16th century said, "Salute thyself, see what thy soul doth wear, dare to look in thy chest, for 'tis thine own, and tumble up and down what thou findest there." Talking with you has been a kind of exercise in tumbling up and down what we find in our innermost being, a kind of tumbling up and down which we all need to discover what matters and, as you write, to make a difference. So thank you. It's been a delight and privilege. Our thanks to Captain Sully Sullenberger for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Alan Jones, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place we are in the know, is adjourned.